Love, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. May I reserve 3 minutes?
That's fine. You may begin when you wish.
May it please the Court, my name is Tom Love. I'm with the Roanoke City Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Villa. The sole issue before the Court today deals with whether or not Mr. Villa had the requisite intent to deprive the victim of her liberty to justify a conviction for abduction with intent to defile. And it's the position of the appellant that an illegal detention or aspiration does not necessarily equal an abduction, that there must also be an intent to deprive the victim of their liberty in addition to the detention or aspiration. That point of law is well codified in 18247 because the code says that you also have to have the intent to deprive the victim of their liberty written into the code. And the case of Burton versus the Commonwealth notes that the two elements of the detention or the aspiration has to be coupled with an intent to deprive the victim of their personal liberty.
Counsel, this is Judge Alston. In this circumstance, could this detention that you're making reference to be justified by the sense or the statements of the complaining witness in a case? Could that suffice for the evidence?
I apologize, Your Honor. I guess I don't understand the.
Let me state it another way. Ms. Vannoy testified that, quote, her arms got stuck between us, and I'm reading from her statement.
Yes,
I couldn't get free. I feel like I held my ground, that I didn't get off the greenway, but I couldn't get free of him. I'm assuming that the government's going to argue that is pretty compelling evidence with regard to the issue of whether or not there was a detention or not. And my question to you would be, why couldn't that evidence suffice to meet the requirements for compliance with the statute by the government?
Well, Your Honor, that testimony would help to establish the first element, which is whether or not someone was actually detained or escorted. It does not deal with what was actually going on in Mr. Billow's mind as to what his intent was, as to whether Mr. Billow had the intent to deprive her of her liberty at the time. And
how do you deal with the legal premise that a person intends the natural and probable consequences of their act?
Because that is merely a permissive inference, and you're dealing with circumstantial evidence in this case to determine what Mr. Billow's actual intent was, because Mr. Billow made no statements at the time to Ms. Vannoy. He simply went up to her after he was exposing himself and masturbating, and his hands went directly under her shirt to touch her breast, indicating a intent for sexual gratification, which is consistent with what the court found in the Johnson case, where the person did, in fact, detain the victim when they went into the apartment under the ruse of getting a glass of water. And the court wrote in the Johnson case that although a detention occurred, it was done in response to his sexual desires as opposed to an intent to deprive someone of their liberty. And
But in the Johnson case, once there was resistance by the victim, didn't the defendant there run away?
Well, in this particular case, when it was a very brief encounter, Ms. Vannoy acknowledged, as is seen on page 74 of the appendix, that the incident occurred for mere seconds. The statement of the defendant, which was introduced by the Commonwealth during the trial, was that as soon as he heard Ms. Vannoy's screams, he realized what he was doing and ran off. So we're dealing with something that happened in a very brief period of time. And although Ms. Vannoy said that not only was she stopped in her running, but she was moved somewhat on the greenway, that greenway is a very narrow area. And although the transcript doesn't show the narrowness of the greenway, there certainly are photographs in the record, Commonwealth Exhibits 2 through 12, that the court could look at to see, you know, that actual greenway and to see that it is a fairly narrow running path.
But to understand your argument, counsel, you're not suggesting in any way that the government could not prove its case unless it had some sort of statement by the defendant. I think that's what I heard you say, that there were no statements made by the defendant.
I'm arguing that if the circumstantial evidence taken as a whole introduced by the government does not conclusively show or beyond a reasonable doubt show that his intent was to deprive her of her liberty, there cannot be a conviction, because when one relies on circumstantial evidence, if it is equally susceptible of two interpretations, a conviction cannot stand, which that has been the law since the older Burton case that I cite and is also cited in Jay versus the Commonwealth. And if solely circumstantial evidence is subject to two interpretations, you cannot disregard.
This is Judge Petty. Is it your position that an intent to deprive the victim of her personal liberty and an intent to sexually assault the victim are mutually exclusive?
It may not necessarily be the case that they are mutually exclusive, Your Honor. However, the evidence has to prove that the accused had an intent to deprive someone of their liberty. And in this particular case, given the gentleman's state of arousal, the fact that his acts were immediately to go for the lady's breast, the fact that this was of a short duration, the fact that any movement that was made of her would have been of a very short distance, it is totally plausible to believe that the only thing on this gentleman's mind in his state of arousal was sexual gratification by grabbing her breast.
Couldn't he have intended to deprive her of her personal liberty in order to sexually assault her?
Well, that may be possible, but it's also possible that he did not have that on his mind and that the only thing that he had on his mind was sexual gratification. And that goes back to the principle about circumstantial evidence. If there are two interpretations that are in equipoise, the trier of fact cannot adopt the interpretation that leads to a finding of guilt over one that would lead to a finding of innocence. And on the facts of this case, that's what the position of the appellant is, Your Honor.
Counsel, this is Judge Russell. In both your briefing and in the arguments below, there was a lot of reference to any deprivation of liberty being incidental to his desire to commit a sexual crime. And I will, in our cases regarding the incidental detention doctrine, there is a lot of discussion that the General Assembly did not intend to criminalize as abduction deprivations of liberty that were part and parcel of other crimes such as a sexual assault. And that logic would seem to apply, could apply whether one charge or two, given some of the language in our cases. However, the Supreme Court in Brown said that the incidental detention doctrine only applies if a defendant is convicted of two or more crimes. Given that, do you concede that the incidental detention doctrine itself has no application here?
Well, the incidental detention doctrine does not have application. I'll agree with you there, Your Honor, because there's only one charge. But on the other hand, the prosecution has to prove the intent to deprive a person of their liberty. And it is not the case that just because someone is detained or escorted, that automatically results in an abduction conviction.
Prior fact can infer that one intends the natural and probable consequences of his act. So if the natural and probable consequences of grabbing this woman constituted a deprivation of her personal liberty, why can't the trier of fact then infer that's what he intended in the course of his sexual assault?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that in this particular case, in light of the actions of the accused of doing what he was doing before Ms. Benoy approached, running up to her and immediately going for her breasts, the fact that it was a short encounter shows that he may well have only had one thing on his mind. The presumption that the court's referring to is a mere permissive inference. It is not a mandatory or conclusive presumption. And it's the argument of the appellant for the reasons that have been elucidated in the briefings that the only thing on his mind was getting sexual gratification from grabbing this woman's breasts.
If he had been charged under 18.2-48, abduction with intent to defile, would the facts have supported a conviction under that charge?
Well, that is the charge that he was convicted of, but 18.2-48 requires the intent to deprive the person of their personal liberty in addition to an intent to defile.
Does it?
Yes, Your Honor, that would be the argument of the appellant. because it says abduction of any person, which if you don't, the only way you have a legal abduction is if you have the detention or the aspiration plus the intent to deprive them of their liberty. That would be the argument of the appellant.
Well, in order to convict under 48, then you have to have both intents.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the argument. That's the argument, yes, sir. Well, other than also mentioning the unpublished case of Lozanzo Bolanos, that points out that if two people are in a fight and one opponent grabs the other opponent in the course of their fight, even if their liberty is temporarily deprived, it's not necessarily an abduction because they're engaged in a fight as opposed to trying to deprive someone of their liberty. And the last point I would make is this case is also applicable to Mr. Billow's situation because although we're not dealing with a fight, we're dealing with someone who wanted to obtain sexual gratification. And similarly, that was his only intent at the time as opposed to wanting to deprive her of her liberty. And for that reason, we'd ask the court to find that the trial court erred by finding the evidence sufficient to convict Mr. Billow. I guess that's mainly what I would have to say unless the court has additional questions.
All right, hearing none. You still have your rebuttal time remaining. Ms. Darren?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Leah Darren for the Commonwealth. May it please the court. I would like to start my argument by pointing out that the issue on appeal is sufficiency of the evidence, and the standard of review for this court, whether it's a circumstantial evidence, as counsel has argued, or another type of case, the Virginia Supreme Court in Hudson, this court in Peace, has said that the standard doesn't change. That the issue is, could any rational fact finder have reached the conclusion reached by the trial court? And we submit that the test was plainly met in this case. The law is clear that a defendant's intent is a question of fact for the fact finder, that a defendant may possess more than one intent, that his intent can be inferred from his acts and conduct, and that the trial court, the fact finder in this case, was entitled to infer that he intended the natural and probable consequences of his acts.
Ms. Darren, can I ask you about the difference between 18.2-47 and 18.2-48? In the Johnson case, he was originally charged with 18.2-48, abduction with intent to defile. He was convicted of simple abduction. And
yes.
Then the court made that comment that his intent was to sexually assault the victim, not to deprive her of her personal liberty, addressing 18.2-47. With that in mind, what's your position on whether a conviction under 18.2-48 requires proof of intent to deprive the person of his personal liberty? As opposed to sexually assault?
Yes. I think that we argued on brief that the Johnson and Burton cases are distinguishable because the detention in both of those cases was accomplished by or attempted to be accomplished by deception or ruse. And in this, therefore, the defendant's intent to deprive the victim of personal liberty is less clear than here or in a case where we have force, physical force used to detain the victim. The other aspect of Johnson, which was in 221 Virginia, is at that time no aspiration of movement or aspiration of the victim was required and not present in that case, where now the law has cleared that we don't have to have movement or aspiration, although we certainly have evidence of that in this case. So we submit that those two cases upon which the other counsel has relied on brief are clearly distinguishable because of the nature of the deception being distinguishable, the detention by deception versus actual physical force.
My question is, do you have to prove two separate intents in order to sustain abduction with intent to defile?
Yes, I think he's correct on that point, that you have to have the intent to physically detain, to detain, and you have to have the intent to deprive the victim of personal liberty, the freedom of from bodily restraint. That has to exist along with the intent to defile. Now, the intent to defile has been conceded by counsel, and he has focused solely on brief and in his argument that there was no intent to deprive of personal liberty. But the court certainly found that in this case, and the record does show that the defendant did more than what was necessary to accomplish the touching in this case. As the court found, and the record reflects, Ms. Vinoy was running, and he stopped her forward movement by body slamming.
Let me ask you a question the other way. It's a follow-up on Judge Petty's question. From these facts, assuming that the defendant here did not accomplish what I think everyone will agree was his primary objective, and that was to touch the woman inappropriately, could you have made an abduction case if she had gotten away?
Yes, absolutely. If she had simply been standing still, and there was, and we just setting aside the evidence that's been conceded here that there was an attempt to sexually molest her, we do have an abduction in this case. We have an abduction based on the fact that she's running, and he has to body slam her in order to stop her forward movement. That of itself is an abduction. We have him wrapping his arms around her. We have him pinning her arms down, and we have her testimony that he pressed up against her, and he was pulling and forcing her towards the side of the trail where there was an embankment and vegetation and a downward slope to the river, and she resisted being pulled off the trail by planting her feet, or I can't recall exactly what she said, but clearly these actions, from which the trial court was entitled to infer from his acts his intent, and he was, of course, also entitled to infer that he intended the natural and probable consequences of his act, and the fact that we can have more than one intent, plainly, we have the intent to abduct here. The elements of abduction were met in this case. This case is a lot more like the unpublished cases of Ellis, but also that Lonzo Bolanos, which is an unpublished case as well, case that other counsel has alluded to. Both of those cases were cases where the abduction was affirmed, that the evidence of force, there was evidence of force to detain and an attempt to move, to transport or move. And that's separate and apart from the force that was necessary to accomplish this sexual assault. I mean, as the judge pointed out, he could have accomplished this act by, if she'd been standing still, he could have walked up and touched her. If she were running, he could have run alongside her. The fact that he applied force to stop her and his other actions of wrapping his arms around her, pinning her arms, attempting to pull or force her towards the side of the trail, all of those acts were not attendant with the sexual assault and the touching. And so we submit that the evidence in this case was plainly sufficient to support the conviction, and we ask the court to affirm.
All right. Any questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Love, you have your 3 minutes remaining.
Yes, sir. Thank you. First, I'd like to say, in response to the Commonwealth's argument about the Johnson case being one that's based on a ruse, Your Honors, in that case, the ruse was to enter the apartment to get a glass of water. Mr. Johnson actually did grab the victim, and she was able to tell the state in which he was with from feeling that state. And the court found that he acted in furtherance of his sexual advances and not with the intent to deprive the victim of her personal liberty, although such a deprivation did occur momentarily. So the Johnson case actually dealt with a touching. The difference was that the victim was not in motion.
Mr. Love, I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Ms. Darren to see what your response would be. Setting aside the touching aspect of this particular case, could the Commonwealth, in your view, have made its abduction case, abduction just standing alone, based upon these facts? And if so, if not, why?
Based on if the man, if Mr. Miller had simply touched her breast and that was all, is that the question?
No. Take out the touching aspect of the case. Just the act that occurred prior to the touching. Could the Commonwealth made its abduction case just from that? And if not, why?
An abduction case from him standing on the side of the I guess I just don't understand the question, Your Honor. I do apologize.
Okay. Go ahead and continue with your argument.
I apologize, Your Honor. The second thing I would say about the body slam, that's addressed in the brief. It's not the conventional thought of what a body slam would be. With regard to the Ellis case, Your Honor, the defense would argue that is a situation that is not analogous to Mr. Billow's situation, because in the Ellis case, the defendant did not do anything to touch the victim sexually immediately like Mr. Billow did. Mr. Billow didn't make statements like were made in the Ellis case, and there wasn't this stated intent that he wanted to take her to a back room, which was in the Ellis case. And so the defense would argue that the Johnson and Burton cases are more similar to what is going on in this situation. And the core of the matter, Your Honors, is that when you have circumstantial evidence to determine this element of the crime of intent, whether you had an intent to deprive the victim of their liberty, and that circumstantial evidence can be viewed in two different ways, one of which is totally consistent with innocence and totally plausible, which is what the appellant is arguing, then the trier of fact should not have rendered a conviction. And I'm sorry, I was not able to understand your question, Your Honor. I apologize.
Yes, sir.
I'd also like, if I could just have a second, to thank the court for granting me a continuance of the argument last week when I didn't have a voice. I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honors, and thank you, Ms. Darrow.
Thank you very much. All right, the case is concluded.